This is the start of the November 11th, 1986 interview with Frank "Sonny Boy" Segree of East Point, Florida. This interview was done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project, and the interviewer is David Taylor. Now, the first thing I wanted to ask was, when were you born?
September 27, 1933.
And where was that?
In East Point.
Oh, yeah. Now, before we started the machine, you were telling me a little bit about your father and grandfather.
My grandfather was born in Pensacola. He came to Apalachicola when he was a teenager, he and his brother.
What was his name?
Anthony Segree. He later went to moved to Carabel. He and his brother was in business, and there's not enough business in Carabel and Apalachicola to keep both of them going as the family growed. So he moved to Carabel and went to work with a lumber company as an interpreter and fished commercial fish as a sideline. Keep it in mind, back in them days, there just was very little ice available. So the fishing season and the fish business was salt fish. You salted at a steamer, a larger vessel, so you salted the fish. My daddy was born in Carabel, and during that time, the GFHNA, you may not be familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
Georgia, Florida, and Alabama Railroad Company. And the line run Tallahassee to Carabel. And they had a steamboat from Carabel, Apalachicola, Panama City, Pensacola, and Mobile, which was called a tarpon. It was one vessel, and then he had two smaller boats. Now, you probably pick up on the name, the tarpon.
I can show you some pictures of it. Okay. You got some, too, yeah.
So, and most of our stuff, our stuff went out on by this rail. It was a company in Carabel. It established the oyster house in East Point, E.R.L. Moore and his son. And the fishing was good because of very little civilization in this part of the country. My father came down here, and his father, East Point, and worked one winter. The next winter, they bought some property, and my father moved down, and he was 13 years old. My family's been in East Point ever since.
What was your dad's name?
Frank Archer Dean Segree, Senior. I'm a junior. There's two of us, boys. I only have one brother. Of course, I got three sons and one daughter. But we've been in fish business from all phases. We had one of the biggest factories here until the late 50s. Of course, things have changed, the techniques have changed. It's one of the things, you know, that makes it hard to understand. We used to produce a lot of seafood in this area with a lot less technology than we do now. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what people think or not, there used to be more vessels work this area than there are now. Some of the young people tell you there's too many vessels. That's probably true, but I can show you documental proof where there was more boats and more people than there are now. Just look at Apalachicola. You could just, with your eye, tell there was more food.
Sure.
Okay. Now, they had one plant in Apalachicola that run a good many on the west side of town. He was producing over 5 gallons of oysters a minute any season he run. Now, that's a lot of oysters. Mm. The whole entire county don't produce that many now. Mm. So I come along right at the latter part of the Depression. And when I started remembering things, there was no money. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, my uncle was in the fish business, and he was a figurehead. You had to make do with what you had or had to make it. No credit, there was no money. What stuff you produced, he either traded it for fish, potatoes, or chicken. And if there's any money, he kept it to keep the families going. Now, we were crannies. We're not tied in the sense. We're crannies. If there's any money, which was very little, he kept it. He kept the old truck going or to do this, to do that. So we had to exist off of technology or, you know, off the land. And true enough, I feel looking back now, we fared better then than we are now. You know, because now there's a certain amount of money that has to come out of them every month, because it's back in those days, we didn't have any utilities or, you know, have the things we have now. We made our own, built our own boats, and even do that today. We build our own oyster tongs. We build our own nets. We made our own dyes for the material for the nets. You never see anybody do it now. We used to take the bark off of oak trees and soak them in barrels, and the acid, you know, becomes, and we dyed our nets with that. Just about in my time, and unless you mastered all of these things, you was paid according to what you could do. You know, in other words, call a man, we'd put on a newcomer, he would be a half a share man. And as he learned to patch a net, he would become three-quarters share man. Or when he mastered the art of things, he'd get a full share. So usually a teenage boy, one would started off as a half a share. So that gave him incentives to master the patching the net, to do another thing.
What were the other things that you had to know to earn your full share?
Back in them days, we was fooling with different types of nets. When I was a boy, cotton net was all it. Okay. So it only lasted maybe 90 days, if that. It took a lot of skill to fish a cotton net. And crabs, there was a lot of crabs that would eat hold in it. So they was from 1 to 2, 3 hours every day a repair to the net. Then the flax come along. Well, it was better. It didn't take quite as much. Then the nylon come along. It was still better. Now then, we got the monofilament. It don't take a damn bit of skill. You take a fella from Georgia or New York or Chicago, can stretch that monofilament out. It's the color of the water. It don't take any skill. He'll get the fish if they're there. You ask me the other things that it takes to be able to undershare, well, you have to know how to safely preserve the fish. You have to know how to oar a boat or man the boat, how to do the maintenance on the boat, and you got to have some knowledge of the marketing. That's the basic things. Now, and we're talking about fishing with a net boat. Of course, oystering is a number of things. It's how to work the boat, how to man it, how to leave it in a position where if the weather comes, you know, it won't be banged up. You got to know how to get around in all types of weather. Mostly nowadays, when you need a piece of equipment, you go to the hardware store and buy it. But back in them days, you didn't. You went, if you knocked a hole in a boat, you put it on the beach, you repaired it yourself. If you needed oar, you had to go get your piece of hickory and make the oar. of course, the outboard motors come along about the time that I was a teenage boy. Up to then, we used whatever we could get. We'd have sails in the gillnet skiff. I'm in centerboard. I remember that. No, you're older than I am. Most of the steamers, the launches they referred to, had automobile engines, Model A's, Model T's, or whatever they could get for nothing. And that's what some of the heavy-duty engines, old single-celled engines that you read about in, was expensive. They were the better thing to have, but most of the boys on this side of the road used automobile engines, Model T's and Model A's, the first one thing or another, because you could buy them for $8 or $10, an old car. And they usually had one on the boat, one in the truck, one in the shade tree. It took, you know, it was not very reliable. Mm-hmm. But then we used to use catfish baskets, trout. We put them in the river and catch freshwater catfish. We made that from scratch. We made it from the palm limbs, was the outside of the basket. We used the grapevines for the hooks. We used hickory for the muzzles, rive out the, and work them down with a drawing knife. And they were real effective.
What did they look like, those baskets?
They looked like a barrel. I'll get you something to show you a picture. They're about 6.5-7 foot long, 18 to 20 inches at large end, 6 or 8 inches at the small end, two sets of muzzles in them. And we used to use cheese or shrimp heads or whatever for bait. And they were real effective, you know, they could catch them. Then we had the crab business. We used trot lines, about a mile of line, you know. We used various things for bait with a trot line. Now, this was a big industry in this area. For years and years, it was a crab business. And we used bacon trimmings. Back in them days, you could buy bacon rind, cow trimmings, you know, from the slaughterhouses, eels from the river. And nothing, you know, for each boat, 1,000, 1,500 pounds of crabs a day. Whatever your plant capacity was, how many boats you put to work for you. But it used to be 5 plants here. Hmm. And they handled 50,000 pounds of crabs every day.
Wow.
Now then we went into the crab business, trout business, you know, since I was grown. And they used traps, of course, they fish around the clock, the traps doing, around, you know, year round, around the clock. And the crabs are like the shrimp and the other things. It hasn't been too plentiful the last few years. So they got their problems too. But now the shrimping, I guess Apalachicola wrote the book on shrimping. I told you a while ago, there's very few power boats. When I first started being old enough to remember, the shrimp nets must have come to Apalachicola around the early 30s.
Mm.
And as the tale goes, and this is talking from my father,
yeah,
there was a man in Mississippi made the first shrimp net that was used on this coast. We had 3 big processing plants in Appalachia, and they brought the first one over here, and somebody showed them how to set it up. And it was real, it worked real well. And of course, from that time to then, everybody picked up on the shrimp business, but I think Apalachicola was in the beginning of the shrimp.
Yeah.
And of course, I've seen the oyster do all kind of things, you know, through the years. But most of us boys built all of our equipment. Now, I did not build the boat that I got now, but all the other boats I've had up to then, I built it myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of a family venture.
What was the first type of fishing that you ever did?
Gill net fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I seine fished quite a bit with Captain George Curvin.
I've talked to Captain Curvin. Yeah.
I fished with him 8 years from the time I was, I guess, about 18, 19 years old. He's one of the better fishermen in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Fine gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's real knowledgeable of what was going on, real good conservationist. At that time, we produced a lot of stuff. We had 3 conservation officers in this area. We had one in Caribbean, one in East Point, and one in Appalachia. And they usually met the boats every day. And if we had a problem, well, he would tell you what the problem was and assure you what you could look for the next day if you had the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, most of the fishermen were good conservation, born and raised here. And if there was a problem, it was oversight or something, was it deliberate.
Yeah.
We had very little problem up to in the late 40s, and had a lot of fish to catch too. You could catch it back in them days. So that questioned my mind, what made that happen. But most any of the fishermen can build any of the equipment that they need if they have the source. Now, we used to have a lot of sawmills here and mill a lot of lumber, and you had no trouble picking the ideal lumber. But a lot of the boys used plywood, but it's short life. Plywood boats are pretty boats now, but they're very short life. You got some scarce here boats in this area that's 75 years old. Plenty of these fishing skiffs, 30, 40 years old. Hmm. The old time was built from Cypress. I think 10 or 12 years, these plywood boats, probably about the life of them.
Are there boats still around that are plank boats?
Oh, yeah, plenty of them.
Skiff, I mean, the skiff, oyster skiff type boats?
Yeah, that's mine right there.
Oh, yeah. And that's one you built yourself?
Yes.
Yeah. How long is that one?
22 foot, 6 inches.
How wide is she?
6 1/2, I believe.
Yeah. How old is it?
It's either 7 or 8 years old. It's not that old. I built that when I realized that I was going to move back to Franklin County.
Well,
it has a spino bow on it. You've asked it, kind of unique.
What kind of bow?
Spino. Some of the boys refer to it as a model bow. When we get through talking, now.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
It's a cross bottom with a full model bow. It rolls and see very few of them anymore because they're hard to build. It's slow. But it's beautiful. It cuts the water beautiful.
How did you learn how to build a boat like that?
I observing the old timers.
Yeah. Who were some of the old timers who were building boats here?
Alice Smith, Joe Brennan, Hallie Kempo, all these people. They used to be a number of shipbuilders around. I guess Alice Smith built one boat behind the other in all of his life. Hmm. Always somebody wanting to build a big trawler. Hallie Kempo, he built same way. He had a little shipyard. Had a couple of Greeks in town that was real good. They built for the sponge fleet and the snapper fleet. Hmm. Referred to him as Carpenter Nick. That's the record just showed. Then we had the Brown boys in Carabelle. They were all my father's age and older. They were real good boatmen. So we used to shoot the bull, call the shop, and anybody developed some technique that was, they'd pass it along. In them days, there was no trade secret, a lot of hard work. Same way with the net construction. You built something that would work, well, pass it along the word, One of the things that I'm partial to, and I was telling you about the hard times when I was a boy. Went to the post office one day and we got a little postcard, linen, net, and twine, in New York. And he told what his inventory was. And he said, you or any of your family can get any of this stuff. And you begin paying for it as your seasons. Mm-hmm. My daddy said to me, said, things are fixing to get better. I said, I don't understand. How could, he said, well, up to this, we couldn't get anything to work with. The man said, and he'll send us some stuff to work with. And from that day to this, things were better. Meaning that was the beginning of the first credit or getting a fisherman was established, and he was always partial to linen, net, and twine, because they extended us credit when we were so destitute. Hmm. But they always had a good product to them, and they're still in business.
In your days of fishing, were the nets always made from these panels of webbing that you get now, or were they completely made by hand in past years?
Well, we made the bail nets, and you can refer to them as a dip nets. Mm-hmm. We even do that today. We knitting them by hand. And the bags and the cast nets. But as a gill net, most of the webbing was made from the panels, stock webbing, because it's so slow. But we used to make the walls for trammel nets, and it's about a 4-inch mass. We'd make them rather than buy them. Mm-hmm.
But what is a trammel net? I've heard people say that, and I don't really understand what they're like.
Well, a trammel net is a three-wall net. It has, a euchre. It's 4-inch mesh from the top to the bottom. Mm-hmm. Then it'll have an inch and a half from the outside, the two outside. Mm-hmm. The theory is when the fish runs and hits it, it'll catch any size fish. And some people refer to it as a pocket net. When the fish hits it, it'll push this piece of webbing through the other piece of webbing, then become in the pocket, and you can't get out. So it'll catch any size. It'll catch it from inch and a half to any size, 150 pound or whatever. So that's the theory of a trammel net. They real effective.
People use those pretty commonly now?
You can only use them after the water temperature goes down. You can make one strike with them now while the water's warm. You'd be all day clearing it up. You'd have catfish. So when the trash leaves the bay, you can use it. Mm-hmm. So you can use it anytime. It would be effective. It'll catch as much stuff as undesirable. You never clear it up. The monofilament I was telling you a while ago was a skill. When I was a boy, you had to be careful where you struck a net. You'd get a load of catfish or whatever. That's the reason you had to be skillful to know where to strike. Nowadays, you can just strike anywhere that's monofilament. You can just shake out what you don't want. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't do that when I was a boy. You'd make a strike in the wrong place, but that was the end of your net. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of other trash, you know, sharks, this, that, and other.
Was all your fishing mainly in the bay?
Fish all over the Gulf. And the seasons we even do now. We migrate in Louisiana about as far as I go, then up the coast. We always own the smaller boats. My boat's 37 foot. Hey, baby. My boat's 37 foot. And it's known as a coastwise boat. We used to fish the bigger boats, the double up, and we'd go to Campeche on the Mexican coast. And we did that right on up to them.
I don't
want to
play if you want to. Be real quiet. You can play just a few minutes.
Then our president decided that we needed a 200-mile limit. And that dealt the fishermen a tremendous blow. It was 3 months a year. From that day until this, all the stress is on the Gulf Coast of Florida. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At that time, it was a third of our fishing that was done on the southern coast. Mm-hmm. That was a tremendous blow. Mm-hmm. It turned one of the things that done all turned all of the big trawlers up and down the coastwise here.
Mm-hmm. If we can go back a little bit, you're telling me that some of your first fishing experiences were with gill nets. Did you tell
yes.
me?
Yes.
And about how long did you stay with that type of fishing?
I gill netted from the time I was a boy until I went to work with Mr. Kirvin. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kirvin was one of the better producers, had a better outlet for his fish. We used to fish on orders. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Kirvin lived in Apalachicola, and he's a real good fisherman. I fished with my uncle and my daddy. Back in them days, we fished a little different than we do now because we oared around. We didn't have the motor sitting in the skiff like you see now. Mm-hmm. We fished 250 yards to each net. We fished two nets together to get around the fish. We'd do this. Mm-hmm. Now then they
went on a circle.
Yeah, but back in them days we had to catch them this way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, as I grew up, Mr. Kirby realized I was skillful, you know, and couldn't help keep up the gear. Well, I asked him for a job, and that fall he put me to work. I used to fish two boats in the fall of the year, Mr. Kirvin did, and one through the balance of the year. So he picked it for when he picked me up that fall and I worked on the second boat, I guess that probably I fitted his needs, so I just stayed with him and I got enough. When I left fishing, I went into the shrimp business.
Mm-hmm. How long did you stay with Mr. Kirvin?
Almost 9 years.
Yeah.
I think I fished nine falls when I got some pictures here I can show you of some of the catches.
Okay.
I think I fished nine falls and eight full years or something with Mr. Kirvin. And at that time, the larger trawlers was coming and we started fishing across. And when I say across, I'm talking about on the Mexican coast. We refer to it as Campeche or Contour. And to make more money, that's what I did.
Was that for Mr. Kirvin too?
No. Apalachicola, one of the We've always been there. Franklin County's always been kind of slow and changing because of availability of money. When we got in this big boat business, the first offshore banks was Tortugas. You familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the war, some of the boats, when these shrimp were discovered, they went down and they done real well. Well, one of the Apalachicola boys, he had gotten a government loan and he bought a boat and it was large enough. He went down and he done real well, so he built some more boats. And then one of my cousins was a captain. I went down and made a few trips with him. Then they had another boat built and he got the new one. I got that one. So that was the story on that.
Hmm.
And I think we'd started building the bigger boats in Apalachicola. Must have been 50 was the first big boat was built in Apalachicola. And the man you mentioned a while ago, his father was the first one that built one. The Contiki was the name of it.
Hmm.
Then the Lady Madeline, they come like a clockwork right on down the bigger boat so we could fish anywhere we wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Up to then, we were our range was limited.
Did you have any kind of electronic gear on your boats then?
Back in them days, we used a Sexton.
Hmm.
And along with the latter part of it, we had a RDF on there.
Mm-hmm.
But I come along in the time of all the electronics. When I first started fishing, we just used a Sexton and a sounding machine, and we did use RDF. It was hard to operate, not very reliable.
Mm-hmm.
The lower end came after the end, and the radars came after the end, and all the other modern equipment come in my time to the fishermen. It was there, but we never was could afford it.
Did you ever use ranges or landmarks that you can find? Fine fish?
We do that all the time, always.
Yeah.
We use all kind of techniques. We'll blow a balloon up, catch a fish, and if we want to stay in the fish, we'll blow a balloon up, for instance, and put it on a piece of line and hook it on a fish and throw him back overboard. He'll stay right along.
Is that right?
Yes.
I've never heard of that before.
We do it all the time when we fish it.
With gas in the balloon, you mean? Or just
no, if you wanted to keep was watching some fish and they was moving,
yeah,
and you wanted to keep up with them,
mm-hmm.
You got to keep your eye on them so they, you know, they'll show and they won't show and they won't show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we do is blow a balloon up, a colored balloon, and we'll catch a fish. And we'll rig up a rig and we'll put the balloon where they have enough water. Depth, you know, so he'll stay right along in the school so we can stay keep up with the school. There's all kind of techniques.
How do you attach the balloon to the fish?
We do it with a device, you know, on his tail or on his fin.
Like with a hook or line?
Yeah.
Well,
that's really one way of keeping up with them, you know, when you're watching fish, and especially mullet when they're going to go offshore the road, so we know where they're at. Other way is using a plane, you know, we use a plane to keep them. And of course, the plane talks to it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you got to pay him a toll too.
Mm-hmm.
But Nah, we these ranges. We use the ranges. We rely on the ranges as well as we do anything. All these oyster beds, we have ranges. We can go in and we stop. We right where we want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Oyster skiffs don't have this equipment that we got on it. But most of the boys know exactly within a few feet of where they're at when they stop. We use ranges. I guess as far back as man's been skillful enough to man a boat. Yeah, or been a vigil mark. You can tell what the birds are doing, what the weather's going to be that like the next day, or the way the cow's feeding on the bank. All these things are factored. If it was one of those skiffs and it was foggy where you couldn't see, if you could see the moon or the stars, you know which way you're going, how to come back to your home and port.
Excuse me just a minute, I gotta turn this over.
These fishermen, you can take any of these fishermen and turn them loose anywhere, and they'd know the direction right off by looking at the stars and moon tell you almost within a few degrees of what course they were running.
Hmm.
And most of them, they use a sounding lead, they can tell you where they are, you know, in the gut, by the strata of the bottom, you know, the marine life. Just seen it so much on every day, you know what area produces this, what area produces that. So we send the sounding lead down. Even now, with all the technology we got, we see what's on the bottom, mm-hmm. you know, so we know what area we're in.
Yeah.
And why we know that, so different water temperatures grow different things. So, in other words, we'll say west of Caravelle, we have real cold temperatures, but east of Caravelle, the temperature stays warmer, say 2 or 3 degrees each area, so it grows different.
Mm-hmm.
I know that west of Caravelle, you have no coral because it freezes. It'll start, but it never finishes.
Mm-hmm.
East of Caravelle, you have coral reefs and so forth, you know, and sponge. You don't have west of Caravelle because of the water temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk of fishing, we used to do all kinds of fishing here because this, we didn't have the ice and different things, so we supply and demand. So if we got to fill up demand for this species, we went to the other species. So we used to sturgeon fish on the high river, and that was a big industry. We used to sea catfish with trot lines on, you know, at other times. We had the flounder, we used to flounder with jackpots. That was a slang name. It's not a thing in the world, but there was no gas lighter and electric lights.
Mm-hmm.
We'd take a piece of 3/4-inch pipe, 10 or 12 foot long, and we'd take a piece of cold rolled steel rod and roll it out a rod. The rod's radius would be 3 or 4 foot, you know. And we'd go cut, you know, maybe a pickup load and lighter knots or something. We'd just build a fire in this, and it would extend out over the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So it light up all the water, you know, go along. That's how I was floundering.
Hmm.
That's how the floundering was done when I was a kid, with a jackpot, we called it a fire pot.
Yeah, just to attract the flounder.
Well, yeah, it light up the water where you could see. So,
okay.
And,
what did you use to actually catch the flounder?
We used a spear,
mm-hmm.
and it was made from usually a piece of cypress pole, 6 or 8, 10 foot long,
mm-hmm.
with a, I guess you'd call it a harpoon, made out of cold rolled steel. Now then you can buy a 3 or 4 prong one, whatever you wanted, but we used to use just a straight shaft.
Hmm.
Of course, the all the things that we made, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we always had the old marine blacksmith around there, you know, somebody in there would have a forge or could beat out your anchors or whatever, you know, bend the metals the way they needed to be bent.
Who does that type of work around here now?
Since when my father died, well, my mother kept all of his equipment. At that time, I was working on a towboat
mm-hmm.
for a couple of years. And she sold it to Mr. Richards, referred to as Corky Richards.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to him the other day.
All of his equipment, he's probably modernized it some, but his stuff is my daddy's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
This building they're tearing down, that's where it come from.
Oh.
So Corky has a... all that, all the stuff that my father had.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of the ones, and there's 2 or 3 around here that still does it.
Mm-hmm.
You referred to talking to Mr. King, and Mr. King was real skillful. He come here when I was a boy. I remember when Mr. King's family moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they came here in Wakulla County. But he's a good craftsman. He builds nets. And now, when you go to talking about the oyster knife and hammers,
mm-hmm.
that's something I'd like to tell you about. There was a
yeah.
bumper crop of oysters during, I referred to the ERL, John C. Moore and his father, putting an oyster house in East Point, one of the first oyster houses. Well, there was nothing down there but wilderness, so that oyster house was a 2-story building. The upstairs was a quarter, because he knew that this stuff was here to harvest, but processing it was going to be the problem. So he got some shuckers to come from Baltimore, and they were men, Chesapeake Bay. And they were the one that brought the knife and hammer. So we refer to them, the old people, as when you see a knife and a hammer shucker, as a Baltimore rig.
Hmm.
Because up till then, we used the healing knife or the stabbing knife. We either went in by the heel or by the front. That's all we knew. But the boys, when they came from Chesapeake Bay, they the one that brought the knife and hammer, so we call that the Baltimore rig. Any of the old timers refer to the knife and hammer as a Baltimore rig. Now
those wooden handle ones that Mr. Kane makes, were they
the knives?
Yeah, were they like what the Baltimore guys had, or his?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Except you have to have the plastic on them now, so
right.
Okay, but we was using wood up to then. And there's a reason for it. That wood would wear, when one had a little age on it, it would wear. When you picked that, you never laid your knife down, you picked the hammer up and you have a little break, you'd hit it. You'd lay the hammer down every time, but you never lay the knife down.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fast, mm-hmm. if you see it done. Now they're going into the machine cracker. Mm-hmm. You've seen the cracker. Mm-hmm. Now there's a lot of discretion in what I'm fixing to tell you. One of my cousins, he got drowned a couple of years ago. He's the first man that ever made an oyster shucking machine. And it works the same way. He built it, and it was kind of a death trap. He had it on a mantle off of a little saw and an electric motor pulled it, but the theory was the same. Mr. Roy Smith in Apalachicola, he developed this thing and made it vertical and where it was practical. Then another boy, Mr. Creamer, he done it, by using what we're using now. But Mr. Smith, he patented his and was not selling to the public. This other boy come up with the idea of using the high-speed wheel action. It's just a bench drill motor. And what you're using on the tool on the end that does the business end is milling machine tool or tool for a saw.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we cracked the end of the oyster with, and it takes a lot of the fatigue out of that hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And it speeds up the process.
Mm-hmm.
The knife and hammer, the Baltimore rig came in my time, and the oyster cracker.
Mm. How long did those fellas from the Chesapeake stay around here?
A couple of years.
Yeah.
At least. Some of them are still around. They're descendants.
Oh, yeah.
Because they married and
What are some of the names of those people from the Chesapeake?
Mike Pair and Lawrence Pair are the two gentlemen that stayed here and married. And both of them are dead, but the Jernigans are descendants from them, Aubrey Jernigan and that bunch. Mm. And the Lemoxes,
mm-hmm.
they're descendants from the Chesapeake Bay Shuckers. And we had a few years ago, had a blight and all Chesapeake Bay died. They came back down again, and the catching end of it then, that's when we go into bushland oysters, in sacks or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked here 2 or 3 years, another fleet of them, because I think that was in the 60s.
Yeah.
And of course, part of them, vice versa, these boys were married and whatever, so you still got some people from Chesapeake Bay here.
Hmm. Well, that's real interesting. I hadn't known that influence was so strong here. I knew, of course, that there was an oyster industry up there, but I wasn't sure about the contact between the places.
Well, these commercial fishermen, some of them migrate, some of them don't. We take half of the people in Galveston, Texas. Originated here, Franklin County.
Mm-hmm.
They went over to Texas in the late 40s and got in the fish business. So, all the way, all the way to Chesapeake Bay, we always converse on what's going on, because we're shooting with the same market,
mm-hmm.
the same technique.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a moment ago that you worked towboating. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, this food with oil and minerals was a basic of what we started doing. When hard times come in the fishing business and shrimp business, begin to look around for something else on the bad seasons. So I began towboating. And The first one on there is a deck hand. And I think I worked in the engine room. And of course, I was already a boatman. And the first pilot's job came open, I went to work as a pilot. We was hauling coal from New Orleans at that time to Panama City, the steam plant. Well, I already had a license. Back in that time, you had to have a passenger boat for hire license to carry the people fishing. So I had a license. And the people I was working for had subcontracted one of their tow boats with the government. And that time they was doing the jetty and rock work at Southwest Pass, the mouth of the Mississippi River. So they sent me over because you had people on there and you was transporting people. Mm-hmm. You had to have a license people. And I worked for him a few months and filled out an application with the Civil Service Commission. And it happened to be at a time that normal depletion was doing its job. Mm-hmm. So just a few days after they finished the job, they called me and offered me some employment. I went to work with the Corps on the Mississippi River and tributary. And I worked a few months, and Master died, the captain died. I worked the job, I think, 12 or 14 months, vicing him. Then I was given the job as captain. And I worked the captain or master until Carter's administration. And he trimmed the Corps when he trimmed me in the bunch. Mm-hmm. In other words, the Corps, the job that I'd done no longer exists. They do it mm-hmm. with contractors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then I had to come back to my homeland where.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm back in the fishing business.
What type of fishing did you get into right after that?
Shrimp boat. Mm-hmm. Won't miss shrimp boat and a gillnet. I don't have a gillnet now, but I built this boat because I seen what was happening. And when I gillnet when I first come back, and we caught a lot of fish, but we couldn't sell them. Hmm. And it didn't take me a few weeks to pick up on when I had a problem. It was the markets had changed. Mm-hmm. And maybe I could fish a day or two, then I'd be 3 or 4 or 5 days before I could sell any more fish. And it's even that way, well, other than roe season, you can sell the red roe, you got to throw the white roe back usually. We used to have awful salt fish market. We don't have that anymore because salt fish is still just as tasty, but when you do things with labor, labor is expensive. So it's just not feasible to split in salt fish, electrofish, and various things, you know. So it's just not feasible, so just abandoned that.
Yeah.
It used to be you work a man and you work him according to what he done, you know. If he come down and he could split 300 pounds of mullet in an hour, well, he made some money. If he could split 100 pounds, he made very little money. Mm-hmm. But that don't work anymore now. You got to pay him wage an hour.
Yeah.
So some of these things that we used to do just not feasible anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you have your own seafood business, or do you sell to people
no,
who do?
No, I sell to other people that have the business. Mm-hmm. I've never owned a seafood. Well, I had a crab business. Me and my father together in Caribou one time, but I'm a better fisherman than I am a businessman. I've always worked the boats. And I tried that crab business in Caribou. We've done all right with it, but I never was satisfied. That always bugged me. I wanted to be on the boats.
Mm-hmm. How big is the shrimper that you have now?
37 feet. Inez, bring me those the pictures of Lady Kimberly and maybe those albums that I had the other day out here.
Do you keep your boat here in East Point?
The majority of the time I do today, it's in Apalachicola. Mm-hmm. I use it. Yes?
You'll have to have it come fine because they mix up again and I don't know which one.
All right, now he's got a mic taped to me. When I get through it, I'll look him up and let him look at it.
That's fine, yeah. I think I may have seen her around. The name sounds familiar.
Yeah, well, some of the people that you same department you were with was down just before the seafood festival and made some pictures over there.
I was taking pictures over there.
And you talked to me then.
Did I? I don't remember that.
It's either you or your partner won.
Well, there was a young lady with me taking pictures.
Come on in, Steve.
Is Steve in here? I got something to show him.
Yeah, he's in there. Oh, I don't remember the lady.
Yeah, but there might have been people from other state departments there, too.
Yeah, it was, apparently, then.
Oh, yeah.
This guy said he was related to the Forwards.
I don't know who that would be. Must have been from a different department in state government. A lot of people with cameras.
He got me to sign a little thing there if they use that.
Oh, yeah. That's a standard practice. Yeah. Give permission.
So he was, it was authentic. Yeah. He was with the state.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you might have seen the picture of the boat there then.
Mm-mm.
But anyway, that boat is one of the things I'm in trouble with. When I bought it, like I told you, because of press back in the fishing business, and it's a PCA loan. It was you familiar with PCA?
No, what does that stand for?
Well, we call it Northwest Florida Farm Credit Association now. They emerged, there's two or three of these people emerged. Uh-huh. But they're the same people foreclosed on these farmers, called them to shoot the head off.
Oh, yeah. Jeez.
And they've been on me and all of my friends, and that's why I was wanting to have audits with the mm-hmm. with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to do it if we don't catch some fish or something happened. And the governor could help us, whether the black women think they could or not. If we could talk to the governor, he could at least get SBA to help us
mm-hmm.
or get him to accept this interest.
Mm-hmm.
I sent them the interest on my loan, and they said they would not renew it. They would keep it in a delinquent status until January 1, and then it would foreclose. But they told me that after I'd sent them the interest. I wouldn't have sent them the interest first, And all this, I got letters. That's the kind of stuff I'm, mm-hmm. why I was wanting to order. But the governor, he's so busy politicking this, that, and I don't really think he's got the time to talk to us.
Yeah. Well, the new governor, maybe something different will happen here.
Yeah, we'll see.
But you mentioned the farmers, I don't think there's too much difference between, of course, what you do is different, where you do it is different.
Well, the same thing, it grows, a food grows fish. It takes the rainfall and the various things. Did you want to say something, honey?
I wanted to ask you if you've seen what Stevie had.
No. No.
He brought that remote control car over here for Stephen to see.
Oh.
Grown man.
Yeah, that what it is, we out of cycle there, the rainfall and the hurricane and so forth. Everything get back all in. My daddy used to say, just before you start a death, you think you're going to become a millionaire. Then he used to have another saying, we're going to make more money than a show dog and jump over, But the good overdoes the bad,
Mm-hmm.
We get so discouraged sometimes. But the fishing business is a good business, no question about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's a typical year like for you, the types of activities that you would participate in throughout the year?
I like to start shrimping. I'm glad you asked that. I like to start shrimping around the 15th of March, give and take how the winter's doing when the water gets 68-70 degrees. We like to start shrimping. And we like to quit around Thanksgiving. And we pick up with the oyster or the travel net. It's according to which market we're standing. We catch up the slack with the oyster net.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, I'm more of a shrimper now, I'm an oysterman. It used to be, when I mentioned a while ago, that we picked up, we'd tie these smaller boats up and get on the bigger boats. We'd either go to Key West or Tartagas or Campeche, the shrimpers would. So that don't work anymore. So we got all the stresses back on the oyster again, see?
Mm-hmm.
We all of us boys tied up.
With the Lady Kimberly, do you fish only in the bay?
No. I can fish anywhere on this coast.
Mm-hmm.
Different weather conditions.
Yeah, because 37 foot to me seems like not a real big boat.
Well, my boat was built in North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
It was built to work the Carolina coast, and people I bought it from bought it from over there. But it's not a big boat, but it's a double rig boat. It looks like a big boat.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I can work anywhere in this Gulf. My range is one of the things, how much fuel and ice I can carry. But we say we can work anywhere that I can, you know, 5 or 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to be back to home port somewhere to get some fuel and ice.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the seaworthiness of the boat, you can work about anywhere. That, the other boats be mighty miserable when you have to give up.
Yeah.
And, you know, some bad weather conditions.
Mm-hmm. When do you always fish in the daytime or night, or how does
different
that change?
Different species.
Yeah.
Okay, we got... We right here in this area, we have three species, actually four. But the DNR recognized three species. We refer to it as the hoppers. That's the cold water shrimp we refer to. It's the one with brown little spots on it. Then we have the hobo, which is a brown shrimp. Then we have the white shrimp. Then we have one that's called the sea bobs.
Hmm.
That you never hear them talk about much.
No, I've never heard of.
They're a mud shrimp that grows along the Cape beaches, you know, in a mud barrier, and they never get very big. And they're more or less a popcorn shrimp. That's where it come from, was popcorn shrimp. Not very, ever worth very much. And they're hard to handle on the boat because they're small and use a lot of fish in. But there is four species of shrimp in this area, but the DNR only recognizes three.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, how do they...
Actually, five, because you have the rock shrimp.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how do they change throughout your fishing year? When do you go after certain ones of them?
Well, the hoppers, and we talk pretty well, starts off in March. Okay, well, in the shallower water, now, we have some hoppers that move on off in deeper water. But about the time, the hoppers last about 90 days. In this area, in my range. Then we go over into the brown shrimp, hoboes.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually they remain from, say, June, July, and August. And the latter part of August, you usually have 2 or 3 weeks that the marine life, jellying, stinging, nettling, so forth in this bay gets it that you can't work. So we just stop and repair our gear, and all we know in September, latter part of September, we go to white shrimping. So then we white shrimp from then to after Thanksgiving, a latter part of December. When everything's in cycle. Now last year it worked all different, and this year it's been much different.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the species of shrimp. And we catch enough fish, it's significant difference. Now we catch a lot of flounders in the run of a year, you know, we catch anywhere we say from 40, 50 pounds of flounders a night to none, you know.
This is in your shrimp trawl?
In the shrimp trawl, and we usually process them. So in the run of a year, we've caught a lot of flounders and other fish that,
mm-hmm.
that we don't recognize, but it does help the tonnage, you know.
Yeah. Do you use the same type of trawl for all the, no? How is that different?
Well, we live in a highly regulated society.
That's the truth.
So,
mm-hmm.
I wish it could. We could use the same stuff, and we could on every species other than the white shrimp. We use a Western jib net or what we call a Florida flat net for the and we're the size is that what we're getting to. When you're in international water or state waters, when you get in this bay, they mix the politics with it, and you can only use, the law says, 1 50-foot net and one set of door. Well, that's what we use for the white shrimp, 1 foot. So we manipulated the law, and we got used to pull 2 22-foot nets in the bay. You have to have some device in the center of them where they don't exceed 50 foot. But now the net we're using now for the white shrimp is known as a bib net. It fishes from top to bottom. The other one fishes 3 foot off in the bottom. That's the difference. But you got a problem there. Some people think that you shouldn't succeed 50-foot. I don't think it makes any difference. Mm-hmm. But we when you switch from one species to the other, then you do have to change your gear around.
Is that because of regulation or because of the way these types of shrimp move around in the wild?
Because of regulation other than the white shrimp.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's believed that if a 50-foot net, in other words, if you got a $50,000 investment or you got a $900 investment, you all pull the same gear according to the way we're regulating. So, in Franklin County, you can pull one 50-foot net according to the law. Make no difference to your size of your boat or your investment or whatever, you pull one net. And, because of the law. Now, these people that indicated this thought that this would protect the industry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're living with. I don't have any problem with it, except it's a lot of work. And when you get down to the nitty-gritty of the thing, it's to make discourage the out-of-towners or the boys that's passing through to make a drag or whatever they got. We got a mass law, they have to be a certain size, this, that, and this. So we've got the law. The laws are set up so that it's not easy for the boat that's migrating through here to go to work. He'll pass it up because he's got to change his gear around.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really manipulated for a reason.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I don't have any problem with it. It just works me sometimes, you know, for me to comply with the law.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem with it. I don't. Myself, I like to pull 125 on each side. I still 50-foot, you know, but they don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But
how big is your crew on your boat?
Well, my boats usually use one, sometimes two, according to what we're doing. But up to this fall, my boys has always worked with me since I had this boat, one or the other of the boys, and sometimes both of them. But right now, one of my boys has simply been so poor that he's working on a bigger boat. They've been down to Key West, and I picked up a neighbor here. He's been working with me the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Does your wife help out in any of the
things you do? She does all the book work, you know. We got to keep up with the same thing any other business do.
Yeah.
We got RS, got to know what we're doing. Department of Commerce needs to know what we're doing. We got the same thing. If I was working 10 boots, as I got one.
Mm-hmm.
She does the book work, and she works on that boat sometime when I got a crew problem or need some help.
What kind of work would she do on the boat with
it? Well, she processes, you know, curl, pick the shrimp out, or do what just regular whatever it is to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. When we first bought the boat, our boys were still in school. Well, she worked with me on kind of a regular basis the first year.
Yeah.
And, of course, I don't mind talking money with you, you know, because IRS knows what I'm doing, you know. You know, if you're interested in what kind of money we make and so forth, you know.
Well,
one of the boys, he scolded me about what I put in the paper. I said, I put in the paper what I want to. That's the way. He didn't want the IRS to know what we were doing. So.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, I don't see where that matters. I'm paying taxes on it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just going to switch the tape. Yeah.
End of tape one. Interview continued on tape two.